How many times has this happened to you? You said, what I need is a great podcast on books. Well, it's here. Chatter on Books, and it starts right now. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your part-time announcer, and here's your full-time host, Tori Clark.
Okay, everybody. Welcome back to Chatter on Books. Thanks for being with us. We're not going to talk about the Washington Commanders, other than to say, one, Tori Clark was very happy yesterday with the Dallas Cowboys' performance, which is a hard thing to say, but it makes me happy. In just a few minutes, we're going to be talking to this amazing woman with her about her debut novel, Parish, by LaToya Watkins. Pretty remarkable book, really unlike anything we've talked about or read on this show before. And the New York Times review, which is incredible, said that it's a brave triumph of a novel that readers won't forget long after finishing it, which is really true. About 15 times a day, I'll think about something that was in the book and go, oh, that's about this. It's impactful, to put it nicely. So we'll talk to her. In the meantime, we have award-winning Claude Jennings looking like a jaunty Navy sailor.
Yeah.
Sailor doing the important work. And David Aldridge and Jamie McIntyre. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
So good to see everybody. I've made it a fall pledge, David. I'm not going to ask you sports-related stuff.
You can ask me whatever you like, Joy.
No, we might get emails along the way, which we'll ask you just to use your relationship with you. But no. Parents Weekend. Have you had it, your first Parents Weekend yet?
Yes. No, we had it a couple weeks ago.
How was it?
Down. It was, thank God, we went 2 weeks ago instead of this weekend, which would have been horrendous weather-wise. But it was lovely. The weather was immaculate. The young lad is, by all accounts, adjusting nicely. Seems like he's relaxed and not too worried about things. And so far, so good. But ask me next week.
Okay. As I predicted, were the kids whose parents weren't there hammered out of their minds? Which is
we didn't spend a lot of time with other parents. My wife and I are very, very cognizant of the fact that the helicopter generation is really helicoptering. It's a really disturbing amount. They were like, well, let's all get together and hang out and go drink together. And I'm like, I don't know any of you.
I don't want to do that.
I have no interest in drinking with you. I'm so sorry. I came down here to see my kid. And that, and then when we're done seeing the kid, we're going home. That's what we're doing. So,
you know, they say that the helicopter parent has turned into the bulldozer parent.
Yeah.
Not just hovering and being there and being supportive. It's now being on the ground, removing any obstacles whatsoever so the child encounters.
Oh, God. I don't even remember having parents when I was in college. I'm sure they were still there, but I don't remember.
When I was in school, you didn't even call home because it was too, it was long distance, cost a lot of money.
Sunday night, you didn't
call. And if you did call, you called collect. And then my mom wouldn't accept the call, and then that would be it. But at least she'd know I was still alive. And that way we didn't have to spend any money.
Absolutely. Honest to God's truth. 2 years at NC State in Raleigh. God bless NC State. Go Wolfpack. Mm-hmm. The entire extent of my parents visiting was when they dropped me off at the campus. I was late. I was, of course, screwed up and didn't sign up on time. And so I arrived late and everything else. And they dropped me off on the edge of campus, said, good luck and off you go. Never saw them in Raleigh, North Carolina again. GW? I transferred? I think they visited once or twice, but that's because my sister Katie was here doing stuff at the arena stage. And so it was kind of a twofer.
Well, here was the thing, and this really wasn't a dirty little secret. We didn't want our parents coming down and seeing what we were doing and what we were eating and how we were living and whether we were going to class. And we didn't, that's why we left.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. All right. I got a couple emails and then we got some book news. Email from Steve Gillingham. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, Steve. Loved the show. Just more guilty about all the books I can't read. Work interfering with life again. On Opal and Nev. That's the final revival of Opal and Nev by Donnie Walton. Mm-hmm. Now, so happy to see Donnie Walton back. Happy to join the not to be sold maybe email list, which is a great reminder, Claude. People should go to chatteronbooks.com and sign up for the email list because
you're
getting all sorts of wonderful stuff, winning lottery tickets, like spend 48 hours shadowing David Aldridge. It's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Giving away on the email newsletter. Thank you, Steve.
Not aware of this prize.
One time, speaking to my sister Katie, back in the 80s, and I lived here in town, and I had my little red Subaru, and I was not always as attentive to parking spaces and parking legality as I should have been. And I would get a lot of tickets. And back in the day, if you got a lot of tickets, you got booted. And one time, the tickets and the boot fees had racked up so it was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars. Wow. Long story short, without her knowing it, I auctioned off a date with my sister.
What?
Yeah.
Yep. Wow.
She was pretty hot in the day, Claude.
No, and I was going to say, because to be able to get hundreds of dollars for back in the day with my sister.
I saw that moonlighting episode. Right.
There was no GoFundMe. There was nothing like that. That was, people had to show up at my doorstep and give me cash. And say it was $700 worth of ticket. I made money. I made money on that. Okay, book news. Maggie Haberman, New York Times, phenomenal journalist. Book is fine after many, many weeks and months of leaks about her book, Confidence Man, about Trump's presidency and his life. It's finally out. My question is to everybody, will you read it? Will you take the time to buy the book and read it? Because we've heard anecdote after anecdote after anecdote from the book itself. We've heard about him flushing notes down the toilet. We've heard about trashing his son-in-law. We've heard so many of these stories in the news. What's the point of reading the book? Jamie, you first.
Well, so I already bought the book, The Divider by Peter Baker and
Susan Glasser.
And Susan Glasser. And but, you know, the being a journalist, the greatest thing is buying the Kindle edition or the because then we just do keyword searches on anything we want to know. And you do end up, when you do that, you know, landing on a passage and then reading a lot more than you thought you were going to read. I was just going to look up, you know, what did General Milley do? And, you know, on the day when they were clearing the park. And then I end up reading two or three chapters, right? Like that. So, you know, I'll probably buy it again. So I have it as a reference. As you said, we've heard a lot of this stuff. Everybody was making a big deal about this anecdote that when Trump was leaving Walter Reed, he had this great idea. He was going to get a Superman T-shirt and put it under his shirt so that he would be wheeled out. And then he would just, you know, jump up and tear his shirt apart with the Superman logo. But I remember hearing that at the time.
Yeah.
You know, because there could be things in there that I might want to reference later and be able to quote them accurately, I'll probably get it and I'll probably read large portions of it.
Can you write it off as a business expense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes,
absolutely. That might be rich enough. David, will you buy it? Will you read it?
Okay. So first things first, I work for a company that is owned by the New York Times. So I have to say that out front. Then I'm going to drink.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to say probably not. With all due respect, I'm sure Maggie Haberman is going to have a wildly successful best-selling book. She doesn't need my $29.95. It's okay. After reading 400 pages of this, what's my conclusion going to be? Yeah, he seems like kind of a jerk. I don't know.
Nothing newsworthy there. David, then Jamie. Okay, but, and I struggled with this at the time as they dribbled out anecdotes from the book.
Yeah.
But months and in some cases years after they had actually occurred, as a journalist, You learn about that, you address it, you've got notes on it, you do interviews on it, whatever. What is the balance of that? Was you're tasked with covering the President of the United States. That's news you have and you save it for your book versus putting it out there. I have mixed feelings about
that's
that.
That's a bit problematic for me too. Yes.
Okay. Jamie?
Well, I have to say that, you know, most of this stuff, as I said, most of it we kind of knew. A lot of it is just confirming things we thought were true, but we weren't sure because we didn't have a first person account of something. But you know, if there was a murder committed, then I think maybe we would need to know about it. But you know, all of these folks do all these interviews. It takes time to synthesize all this stuff, compare it with other, you know, sources. You're going to put it in a book, so it's going to be there in print forever. And you can go into a amount of detail that you simply just can't go into unless maybe you write a 25,000 word story for the New Yorker, but you know, it's not like Maggie Haberman didn't file a lot of stories on Trump. I saw that she actually wrote more than one story a day for the entire time he was president. So I'm sure we got a lot of the information. And as you said, I don't think there's huge bombshell news here. And even when, you know, Bob Woodward had some bombshells in his and people were criticizing him for holding on to it, excitement lasted for about a day and a half. And then it was like, well, that's just Trump.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that there's anything in there that would have changed the course of history had we known it earlier.
Right. I just have, there's a whole industry here in this city.
Yes.
That I've lived in my whole life that I'm not a part of. And I choose not to be a part. I don't want to be a part of it. I just don't get it. I don't understand the notion that you could find out stuff and hold it for a book. It kind of goes against what we do for a living, but that's okay. I'm not judging. I'm just saying it's not for me.
You would do that if you were writing a book.
About a contemporary person? I don't know. It would be hard for me, Jamie. I'm just saying it'd be hard for me. That's all.
Well, the hard part for me would be actually writing the book.
As one of the most people in the most cynical town, Washington, D.C., I think there is one of the highest levels of cynicism is when really accomplished journalists, and I love them, are writing books.
Yeah.
I think that's what they really separate their personal aspirations, ambitions, whatever you call it, from their journalistic whatever. But, you know, I still have glorified notions of what journalists are and what they should be. And I think there's a difference between covering a retired football player and holding on to and working on anecdotes, to your point, Jamie, and really getting every detail and every side of it, and covering a president of the United States. Just as there's no higher ethical obligation, from my standpoint, from a public servant, I think there's no higher standard for journalists than you're working for the flippin' New York Times, and you're covering this person, and you think you're going to hold on to this anecdote that he's flushing possibly classified notes down the toilet. I think that's a problem.
Well, you may recall that Susan Glasser and Peter Baker's book that they were working on, they kept getting scooped by people who were publishing the books earlier. And every time somebody would publish a revelation, they would, you know, Susan Glasser in particular would go on CNN and talk about what was going to be in her book when it came out in a few months from now. So a lot of that stuff, again, dribbled out over time. But I would challenge someone who thinks that we were somehow ill served by people holding on to material to actually cite which piece of information we just had to know beforehand before the book came out.
I can't think
of anything offhand, really.
Here's one. Someone that we've talked about wrote a book about Trump in which he interviewed Trump and had him on tape saying, yeah, we know this virus thing is really, really bad. We know. And we knew that in February of 2020. Maybe that's something you could have shared with the rest of the nation at the time. I don't know.
But again, that's a one day story. So we all knew that Trump was underplaying the virus. I mean, so in a lot of cases, these books confirm what we already knew and provide some factual basis, not just our gut telling us something.
Right.
It made no difference. Once that came out, it made no difference at all in anything, really.
Tori has her hand up, and since it's her show, I guess we should go to her. Tori?
Jamie, you're wrong. And that is a great example, David, because the time gap between when a certain person, President of the United States, said that, and when a certain journalist reported that in his book or shared that in his book, months had passed. And if at the time that President of the United States uttered those words, it had been public knowledge, that could have changed how people reacted to, responded to, dealt with COVID.
Well, respectfully, you're wrong. It would have been useful to know, but it would not have changed a single mind about COVID and Trump's handling of COVID.
Tapes have a way of changing people's minds. Things that people don't believe, they tend to start to believe when they hear it on tape.
It just changes everything. If a tape changes everything,
well, you're
it always
wrong.
Does.
None of those things. We've had, and I will cite as an example, the January 6th hearings, which have all kinds of facts and things that we didn't know. And I would challenge you to find one person who tells you that their view is completely changed by listening to the January 6th hearing. It just doesn't work that way. Not in our information environment.
I don't know, because they saw January 6th play out in real time. And so it wasn't like it was something that they heard and needed the tape to confirm it. They saw it as it was happening.
Yeah, these are
so the people who thought it was legitimate political discourse and that the election was stolen still believe that. And the people who believe it was an insurrection and an attempt to subvert democracy believe that. And I think if you take those two groups and try to find somebody whose mind was changed by the overwhelming presentation of facts and reason and logic, you're going to have a hard time.
Well, hey, I get to finish this conversation because we now have about 30 seconds to cover two important things before we launch.
Because our author is like, why? Who?
What in the world? Have
who's responsible for me being on this show?
Okay, and I'm going to follow up on this, Jamie, but to your point about January 6th and what people saw, as Claude said, in real time, to my knowledge, there has not been really good research done on the reaction to that, both quantitative and qualitative. And someone should do that, and I would follow up on it. But, okay, yes or no, Claude, I keep bringing it up, Claude, David, Jamie. Tom Hanks has a book coming out in the spring. It's a novel. It's fiction. Who knew he had some best-selling collection of short stories? I didn't know that. But he's got this novel coming out. It's about shockingly making movies 1940s to present. Claude, will you read it?
No, but if he makes a movie about it, I'll watch it.
Okay, David?
Not a chance.
Not a chance. Okay, Jamie?
Too many books on my bedside table already. They already are stacked up to the cathedral ceiling, so no, okay. I probably won't read it.
Like Parrish. Okay. David's experiencing this right now. Incoming, we don't call them freshmen anymore at college. We call them first years and we call them all sorts of other things. But there still is required reading. They tend to call it now community experience and these kind of things. But I'm giving you three books and then three colleges, and you guys have to guess which was which. Okay? Ready? Okay, first book, Disability Visibility, First Person Stories from the 21st Century. Second book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks by Rebecca Skloot. Amazing. And then the third one, Report of, it's the name of the school, Steering Committee on Slavery and Justice, examines this university's history and involvement in slave trade and its legacies of racism. Hint, mm-hmm. That third one, this is the third year in a row that reading was selected by the students, the faculty, et cetera. Right. Now I'll give you three schools. Goucher College, University of Kansas, Brown University. So let's go to Goucher first. We're just going to do alphabetical. David, what's your guess? Which of those,
three? Oh, I would say
alphabetical. That's great for me.
Yeah, of those three, I would say Goucher is the second one. What was this? Give me the second one again.
Immortal life of
Henrietta Lacks. Yes.
Okay, Jamie, what's your guess?
For Goucher.
Uh huh.
Oh, I'm going to go with the. The steering committee's report on the history of slavery.
Oh, brandish to me.
Since you were wrong about our earlier topic, you lose. okay, next school, University of Kansas. Jamie, you get to go first this time. You only have two choices. You get 50-50 chance.
I'm going to go with The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks for that one, just because David picked that for a different school, and okay. I want to beat him.
David, you have a guess? Do you want me to remind you of the three choices?
The first one, no, I think Kansas would be the disability book. Because I think Brown is the book about the...
DA crushes. Two to zip. He wins. And Brown University has done this report on slavery and justice as it was carried on by...
Did I say Goucher? I meant Brown.
All right. Latoya Watkins, welcome to Chatter on Books. Thanks for joining us.
And I'm so sorry you got booked on this.
No, I loved it. It's very entertaining.
Have required reading as a freshman? Fresh person?
I did. I I can't even remember the book because I've been in academia since then. And every year there's a new book. So
I went my freshman year, fresh person year, NC State, and I was a pre-vet major. So it was something horrific, you know, like, you know, the best things about organic chemistry or something like that.
I think we read in my school, we read Future Shock, which was this would have been in the 1970s.
Hoffler?
Yes.
Hoffler, right?
Hoffler, yeah. Future Shock. But it was about what the future was going to be like. And I don't remember much.
Any of it.
But I think it turned out pretty much like they said.
David, you're firstborn off at the school now?
Is he? What's he reading?
You know, did he have any first year?
The child tells us nothing about anything that's going on. Are you kidding? I don't even know if he's still enrolled in the college. I have no idea. I don't
know. You know, you laugh about that. Yeah. We know people. Okay, I won't even tell that story because they're too close. Okay, LaToya. from Texas. Unlike most of the authors we have on the show, LaToya, and I admire you for this. There's very little information online about you and your background. Other than from Texas, PhD from University of Texas, at Dallas. Where are you from? What's the backstory? What did you want to be when you were five? Those kinds of things.
I think when I was five, I want to answer that one first because I think that's fun. I wanted to be a pianist.
Nice.
but I wasn't very good at it, and I didn't realize until I was probably about 12. So I pushed that onto my kids later on, and I still don't have a pianist. I am from, West Texas. The Panhandle region is where my family is from, but I was raised in DFW, and have always lived here. I don't have a traditional, student background, like college student background, because I didn't go straight to college from high school. I kind of detoured and became a working person and then gained a family. Yeah. And didn't really learn about the state of Texas until grad school, when I was kind of trying to figure out what I wanted to study. I enrolled in an interdisciplinary program, kind of chose between law school and grad school, and worked around some former attorneys in publishing for a little while. And they convinced me that I didn't want to go that route. So I ended up going to grad school. I thought I would be a historian, and made my way into writing.
It's one of David's many in his next life. He's going to come back as an historian.
No, I was a history major. I respect, I like history people.
Everybody wants to get into the high paying career field of,
yeah, they're
very competitive.
So much money.
But we call you doctor now, right? We should call you
Dr.
Hopkins. Nice.
Well, no, I'm fine with LaToya.
I know several people who, you know, got their doctorates, and they, you know, some of them use it and some of them don't. And I always say, my God, the amount of work, the years, the time, the effort, the sweat, the toil, I think you totally deserve it. I think you should totally embrace it. But how hard was it? How hard was it?
It was hazing is what it felt like, all of those years. And when I first finished it, even now, sometimes when my kids call or when I'm talking to my spouse or even my parents, it's Dr. Wife or Dr. Daughter or Dr. Mom. So I do use it with my family a lot, but publicly it's something that it's an experience that was so difficult that I sometimes want to forget about it. It was very difficult. And a lot of my peers didn't complete it or they didn't make it through. I think sometimes it's a squeezing out or a wringing out, not of your ways of thinking, but of people. Like there are so many people that I started with who didn't make it through the program.
I don't know. I don't know what the numbers are now, but I know the numbers used to be that something like more than 50% of the people who go for doctorates don't make it.
I believe it. And I remember hearing that number while I was there, I actually finished the master's and the PhD program in 4.5 years because I wanted to be like a student that actually made it. And I knew if I looked away or if I took too long to finish it, I wouldn't. I would be like some of the people around me. So
when I was at the University of Maryland, I went back to the University of Maryland and get a master's degree, which, by the way, was just a big enough pain in the neck that I could never consider a doctorate. But I knew a lot of people in the doctorate program there, and a lot of them ended up what they called ABD, I think it was, all but dissertation. They completed everything, but they just could not get that dissertation done. And I know people who ran out of time. They just research, couldn't quite write it, ran out of time, and eventually didn't do it, didn't get.
And there's like 10 years, right?
Yeah, that they have 10 years to do it.
Yeah.
I had 5 years to do my master's, and I almost didn't get that done.
Earlier in the show, Latoya, we were talking my dearly departed sister, who, among other things, helped me pay for my parking tickets. But she broke up with the greatest guy in the world, Lewis Black, and then immediately fell in with this guy, Michael McLaughlin, one of the most appalling people on the planet, who was getting his PhD from Oxford in, I believe, philosophy, which is probably, based on my little bit of knowledge about philosophy, probably the easiest PhD in the world to get. He was getting his PhD from Oxford in philosophy, never finished it, 10, 15, absolutely never finished. He also never had a job. The guy was just a complete and total loser. But I commend you. So where'd the turn to writing come? Where'd that come from?
When I was in the PhD program, I heard that there was like this, you could write your dissertation. You could do a creative dissertation, but no one had ever done it. No one had really gotten their proposal written in a way that they were able to do it. My chair even tried to discourage me from doing it by refusing to chair a dissertation that was a creative dissertation. and I was really determined. He told me I wouldn't be able to get a job. And that it was just worthless. It was useless. And in many ways, I understood where he was coming from because there was something that he was trying to prepare me for. And he was actually, again, this ringing out process. There were a lot of people who kind of turned and decided to do, write a history book or do something on literature or art. But I was like, it's all the same. Like, they're not going to find jobs.
I'm going to be unemployed.
Right. I'm in the arts and humanities. Like, why are you trying to keep me from doing this thing that I really want to study that so many people have said that I'm good at? Can we just run down this area of study? Let me, I'm finding my way here. Because it was this program where you could study history and literature. They wanted to blend the sciences and technologies in a way where you were encouraged to kind of create your own path and study all of these things, except we don't want to take creative writing seriously.
So if you said, so this is a creative dissertation. Now, most people I know have written dissertations are not anything I would want to read. But would this be something I might actually want to read if I went online and found your dissertation? Is it entertaining?
You might. It ended up being something that I kind of met him in the middle and did a scholarly part of it. Half of it was scholarly and half of it was creative. So I wrote a story collection and explained how that fit into the American literary tradition. So I went through all the African-American literature, well, American literature, African-American literature, and the history of these things and how my work fit into that. And then I gave a sampling of the work. So we met in the middle there, and it was something that I was really proud of and in love with. And the first kind of version of this book was in there. It started out as a short story, was the first thing I ever wrote in that program.
Wow.
And it was only after I defended that, that I decided to go back and make that story a novel.
I have so many questions about defending a dissertation, but we'll have to ask that. And that is a great segue to this fabulous book, Latoya Parrish. Jamie, would you like to ask the Jamie question? Yes.
Well, I cheated and read the review, so I kind of know, but I always like to ask, what is the book about?
It's about family, and this family with problems who they've been somewhat estranged, and they're coming back together to bury the matriarch, who's the center and the start of everything for this family. And a lot happens at this kind of reunion at her deathbed. A lot is uncovered and revisited and unearthed, and they have to decide if they will move forward as a family or disperse when she is no more.
It really was. I was saying before you joined us, that's why this is unlike any other book we've talked about on the show. It's phenomenal. And I read a lot, and I read a lot of reviews, and I watch a lot of interviews. I seldom read Goodreads because I just think, you know, it reminds me kind of Yelp sometimes. But I was looking at Goodreads, and I found consolation in Goodreads, because the number of times reading this book, and I listened to it as well, the people who did the audio version are incredible. But I kept reading going, okay, this is really hard. This is really hard to read. This is really hard to absorb, but I can't put it down. And in every review I've read, whether it was the New York Times or one of the 5,000 people who reviewed it on Goodreads, they all said the same thing, which is, this is so hard. And there are stories of incest. I have a crazy family. This put my family to shame. We're like pikers compared to these. But by way of introducing us to some of the characters, whether it was Helen Jean, the matriarch, or Alex, the grandson, tell us about a couple of the key characters in the book and what it was like writing about them. Because this book is told in first person from several different perspectives, and there's a lot to juggle here. But whether it was Helen Jean or Alex or Jan, which ones were the hardest or the easiest to embrace and to write?
I think for me, writing the hardest one was Lydia. Mm-hmm. A lot, and some people that I've talked to, some of the readers found her the most relatable, but sure. She was, she was definitely the hardest one to write. Alex wasn't easy either. Lydia was harder, but she was always there. Like, the story started out with two characters, Lydia and Jan, when it was a short story. So she was always there, but really connecting with her, spending time with her, relating enough to her to kind of figure out what it was that she wanted after I decided to write the novel. I think that was something that I did up until the final revisions of this book. I had to go back and sit with her for a few months and just listen to only her, no one else in the book, to really understand what it was that she wanted from this world and from her life and even from her husband. For Alex, he was difficult because even though at some point in the story, he was a victim, he was also, a victimizer. So connecting with him in a way that I was able to feel for him on both sides of his life, it took some time. And I knew that I had gotten him to where I needed him. I think the first time I cried, like I actually felt enough for him to cry. And that's usually something that I get to in my characters. And that's what has to happen for me to realize that they're actually real to me and that they're ready to go out into the world. But it took me some time to feel enough for Alex to cry. And for a long time, I had his story written, but it wasn't a part of the novel.
It's a remarkably complex book, and I mean that in the best way. So you have several different perspectives, first person, and you seemingly, you know, embrace or become, you know, part of that person as you're writing, different time frames, flashbacks to and from. And then, as you were just saying, the suggestion of this balance, I'd find myself listening to Alex or listening to Jan or listening to Helen Jean and going, okay, hate this person, love this person, hate this person, understand why this person did this. Was that process, that balance, I'm sure that's the wrong word, I'm sure there's some literary expression for it, but was that conscious on your part? Or did that happen organically? Or did you have 9 million index cards on the wall charting all this out?
I think it was more organic. Later on in the revision process, it was probably, I did 11 or 12 revisions of drafts of this work. And I think around the sixth draft is when I went to McDowell Colony and they gave me a wall that was a cork board. And I was able, that was the first time I was able to kind of get an outline in front of me, a working outline, and figure out how to balance out the voices and the story, how to line up the story, who gets to tell what, if there's overlapping or if we hear the same story over and over again. It was very, it took me a while to get to that point. But after that point, every draft, I was rewriting that outline. I actually created the outline in a document, and then I made the font really big, like, and cut it out, printed those pages and cut them out for that corkboard. But I would go in and revise that document when I realized that I had two of the same chapters being told from a different perspective. So there was something that I, some revising that I needed to do, some cutting that I needed to do. I think it was organic until that point. And then I had to strategize. I felt like it became very scientific or mathematical, which isn't my area. So that it became difficult to hold everything together once it was out of my head. Yeah. But when I was doing the free drafting, it was just kind of organic.
Well, the scientific approach worked because there's not a wasted word in it. David?
Yes. First of all, it's a great book. It really is wonderful.
Thank you.
And I know that it was important to tell the story about Black trauma specifically. And because every family has it. I'll be honest with you. When I first started it, I was like, I don't know if I can read another book about Black trauma. And then I started to think about it. And if you think about it for more than 10 seconds, you go, oh yeah, I have this in my family. Oh yeah, I've got an uncle like this. All right. You know, I have a cousin who did that. And you think about it because you haven't thought about it because you chose not to think about it. Right. And so I just, what was important about making that kind of centered in the book or a centerpiece of the book?
At first, when I decided that this would be the novel, the first novel, it was almost like I went through this period of grief because I didn't want to write it, right? Like I didn't want to spend years on end with this story that felt like it could move in that way and become a story about trauma. And I didn't think that people would want to read it. So I had to kind of dismiss the world in order to write the book. So the pieces of trauma, and at first I think I was going to cheat the book. Like I had 19 narrators at first. I wasn't going to go back to any one narrator because that was just too hard. That was spending too much time with these characters and I was going to run into their trauma. And when I left the idea of kind of running into this type of pain, this type of trauma go, then it just seemed to come out naturally and make its way to the center of the book and become something that made sense as this generational, this thing that kind of follows this family from generation to generation. But there was a whole bunch that I had to suspend in order to be able to write the book. Yeah. Like when you're thinking about publishing, in grad school, this was the one story that that committee chair looked at me and said, this is a beautiful story, but it's a hard sell. Nobody's going to want to read this. And I believe that, but it seemed after so many years of researching all of these different things that always ran into this, the story that I needed to go back to and flesh out.
Is it part of the if you don't confront it, you'll never get past it, right? You have to confront it and you'll never get past it, right? And that's true for so many people, so many families.
It is. And I think that's the part that's the thing that was important to me in the very end here, that the silence was something that the silence was the problem. It's the confrontation that needs to happen. It's the speaking to the thing. It's the truth that needs to happen in order to overcome it. So I think if anything took a center, it was that, that we're not going to be quiet about this, that we shouldn't be quiet about this. We should actually look at this thing that is really painful.
LaToya, how did your family feel about the book?
This is funny because I didn't consider my family until weeks before publication. And the only reason that I considered them is because someone asked me about the names in the book. Like, these are some great names. And I was like, yeah, they are. Like, I have names I don't even have to create names. Like, my family, they just have these great names. I have an aunt named Bali Baby. Like, where do you get a name like that? I have an uncle, his name is Herman, but they call him Chimmy. I'm like, these are names that I just write down. And then I thought about the names in the book. I thought about Lydia, who I kind of lifted her name from my mother. And I had to go and tell my mom, your name is in this book. And then I thought about other characters. I went back through and I was like, wow, like I have to address this. They're going to think that this book is about them. These are all their names. And then it dawned on me that if they actually read it, they would know that it wasn't our family. But there was some scrambling for a while. Like, I had a distant cousin who saw something online, saw an excerpt or something, and he contacted his mom and was like, I think she wrote a tell-all book and she's putting the family's business out.
Tell-all.
But it was before the book was released. But I think that he was able to read a review or a synopsis or something. And he thought, like, he saw some names that were familiar and he thought I was writing about family. So it didn't dawn on me until weeks before that this might be a problem, but it's fine. It's been fine.
Among many reasons I will never write about my family. One, nobody would believe it. It would have to be just, you know, highest state of fiction ever. And secondly, they would sue me before that thing hit the first guy. Okay. Let me get you out with this about this fabulous book, Parish, LaToya Watkins, Dr. Watkins. I want to ask about your dedication. Dedication to the book. It says, for Cameron and Colby and all those who saved me.
I was a person who grew up thinking that I didn't like children. And then I became a mother and I was certain I didn't like children. it's such a big task and big, like, you're so important, you're so centered and these people like consume every part of you, that I was like, yeah, I was right, I didn't like children. And then these little boys came into my life for about 2 years and they needed me and they were not my children, but they did need me full time. And then their parents came back and they were gone, but they changed me and they changed the way that I saw children and the way that I communicated with children. It was a different role when that responsibility, like when what they grew up to be wasn't all on me. When I was stepping in as a savior of sorts, right? I was a hero and they loved me, not because I was their mother, not because I had this role, but just because I was. It changed the way that I looked at children. I have really great love and relationship ships with children around me and my family and the community. It's something that it surprises me every day. Children and dogs, that surprises me every day.
Okay. I was just going to say that's one of the nicest dedications ever, but as my friend Jeanette Black, age 104, likes to say, in her next life, she raised two boys. In her next life, instead of children, she's going to have dogs because they're always happy to see you and they're easier to train.
I agree. They've been problems for me too, but I think that it has been related to the children. When it's been related to my children, my relationship with dogs until now. I've always had a dog.
My three kids who are 20 somethings all know it's the dogs, the kids, the husband. That's the
I like that. That's perfect.
Latoya, the book is Parrish. It's fabulous. You know, heads up to everybody. It's as all those reviews said, it's really hard to read, but it is, you cannot put it down. I think it's a necessary book in some ways. And I hope everybody reads it. Latoya, thank you so much for being with us. Absolutely.
Thank you all for having me. This has been so fun. So much fun.
So nice to meet you. Everyone should get Parrish from their favorite local independent bookstore. And in the meantime, we are off next week, folks. And then we'll be back the following week with one of our very rare political books. But it's Mark Leibovich, formerly the New York Times, now with the Atlantic, who's written a wonderful book. Thank You for Your Servitude, which is kind of about Trump, kind of about with the Republican Party, but it's a great book. And Gene McManus is going to join us as a panelist then. So stay tuned.
Nice.
Outstanding.
But everybody, thank you for being with us and thank you for listening. We're out.
Don't forget, you can get bonus content from Chatter on Books and join us for live virtual recordings. Simply consider becoming a member of Patreon. Go to patreon.com/chatteronbooks and enjoy access to all kinds of bonus content and live recordings. That's patreon.com/chatteronbooks. Sign up now and feel the surge of deep satisfaction that comes from being a patron of the arts and a supporter of this podcast.